Scripture reading tonight comes from Psalm 14. Psalm 14, all seven verses of Psalm 14. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that doeth good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside. They are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge, who eat up my people as they eat bread and call not upon the Lord? There were they in great fear, for God is in the generation of the righteous. Ye have shamed the counsel of the poor, because the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel were come out of Zion. When the Lord bringeth back the captivity of his people, Jacob shall rejoice, and Israel shall be glad. Tonight, I'm going to take a topical spin on the 14th Psalm. I read an article some years ago that noted, if you look at Psalm 14 and verse 1, that the phrase "there is usually italicized, which means it's supplied by the translators in order to help us understand the sense, because sometimes word-for-word translation leaves us with what appears to be a little bit of an impoverished phrase, because you can't exactly go word-for-word always and make sense of translation. So sometimes you have to figure out a phrase or something that will help give the sentiment of what's there in the original. And that being the case, when you read Psalm 14:1, it would read without that added italicized phrase. It would say that the fool has said in his heart, no God. That's interesting, isn't it? But tonight I want to think about, why is it foolish? Why is it foolish to not acknowledge God or to believe in God? From an apologetic point of view, we might say that it's foolish not to believe in God or to trust God. For one reason, because something from nothing is impossible. It's an impossibility as far as I understand the physics of our existence. We don't get something from nothing. You can have a bank account with a zero balance, and no matter how long you let it sit there and how long you let it mature, you can go back 500 years from now and the balance will still be zero. That's true theoretically when it comes to math, and it's true physically when it comes to the creation. You cannot have something come from nothing. You also cannot have design without a designer. It's an impossibility that something would exhibit the characteristics of design and there not be a designer on board somewhere. So that makes it foolish to not believe in God. Another reason is because moral value judgments, and I say that because morality as an abstract concept is sometimes easily criticized. So I'll put it this way. Moral value judgments without an objective source for them is impossible. Now, you can make value judgments. You can make judgments about the value of a thing. But you have no objective basis for it. Essentially, the only thing that you have, if it comes from you, is it's your opinion, and you're speaking on the basis of your own authority. And you know, that's the way many people live. I don't think anybody wants to live that way. Ultimately, I think anybody can be pushed into a corner, as Charles Pugh used to tell us, to defend some standard of right and wrong that's outside of the self. I'm not just telling you that you can't thump me because I don't like it. There has to be something higher than that that governs that behavior. Some objective source. So it's impossible to make moral value judgments without an objective source for such. You can't defend them, at least. without there being some divine or some being outside of us that's greater than us, which we call God. I want to suggest to you just a couple others real quickly here. One of the reasons I think it's foolish, another reason that I think it's foolish not to believe in God is because the character of Jesus without an actual person is impossible. I believe that Jesus, and I believe the Bible teaches this, I believe that Jesus is evidence for the existence of God. I don't believe that Jesus can exist without divine influence, without his being divine. I don't believe he could have been created. Now, that's anecdotal, I understand. And it's not my purpose today to give you all the lines of argument for it, but it's my personal belief that Jesus proves that God exists. I don't believe we can have a Jesus without God. And if that's the case, as I've said many, many times, I think we could just create a better one to disprove that theory. And as of now, it hasn't been done. And I believe, finally, the existence of the Bible without divine influence is impossible. And again, I could give the same argument for that among many other arguments, which is simply, if the Bible is not of divine origin, it wouldn't be all that hard to make one better. So if any of those things are not impossible, then Christianity isn't true. Christianity is based upon the idea that all these are impossibilities. It's impossible to get something from nothing. It's impossible to have something designed without a designer. It's impossible to make value judgments, at least make them stick and defend them, without there being some moral imperative that's higher than us. It's impossible for Jesus to be without there being a God. It's impossible for the Bible to exist without there being a God. Those are just a few lines of argumentation as to why I think it's foolish to not believe in God. But I'd like to consider with you tonight two other points. I'd like to consider with you why the fool may have said no to God. First, I suggest that the fool has said in his heart that there is no God, or that God is not consequential, perhaps we might say, because there is literally nowhere else that it makes sense. Why does the fool say in his heart no to God, or that there is no God? Because there's nowhere else that it makes sense. The fool has certainly not said upon reflection of the creation that there is no God, for some of the reasons that I just mentioned and many others. The fool has certainly not said by weighing all the evidence that there is no God. There are always those who say that there's simply no evidence for God at all. But that seems to me to be a completely unjustified claim. The accusation seems to me to be that there is no physical manifestation of the divine being, which is quite interesting because it's not as if the Bible ever claimed anything different. The Bible says from cover to cover, "No man shall see me and live." Jesus is, according to Colossians 1:15, the image of the invisible God. God cannot be seen. There's no fingerprint for God like the one that we leave maybe on our cell phone, or skin cells or hair fibers of God that are left on clothing. There is no DNA as we have DNA for God that might be tested in a lab. And so the assertion is that since God is not a physical entity and cannot leave any physical trace of his physical existence, then there simply is no evidence for God. But this is utter foolishness. It is nonsense. That's why the psalmist says that only a fool would say such a thing. Every word that I have used since I've been up here, and every word that I'm using right now, do they exist? If you say yes, they do exist, then where are they? Where are the words that I'm speaking right now? Are they sitting on the pew over here? Are they hanging from the ceiling? Are they driving by in a vehicle? The words exist, do they not? Is there any possibility that you could be wrong about that? That the words that I'm speaking right now don't actually exist? You can't see them. They have no DNA. They have no fingerprints, no hair to leave behind. Nothing except for the experience that you have with them. Are they less real than the piece of paper that's in front of me right now, or the microphone that I'm speaking into? And what about the thoughts that have preceded every word that I have said since I've been up here? Are they real? Are my thoughts real? Are your thoughts real? Are you sure that your thoughts are real? I understand we can go into some philosophic exercise here. But if we're speaking at a fundamental level, your thoughts are just as real as my thoughts, yet you've never seen your thoughts. There's no physical trace of your thoughts. They're just there and you know that they exist. What color are they? What do words taste like? Can you melt my feelings under high enough heat? Is logic just a group of molecules that can expand and contract if you heat them up or freeze them? Can mathematics be burned to ashes? Can ethics or values be suspended in a test tube solution? Are any of those things real? All the skeptic is really saying when they say there's no evidence for God is that God isn't a physical being. Well, we knew that. That's not proof of anything other than what the Bible already claimed for itself and claimed for God. The Hebrews writer wrote in Hebrews 11 and verse 4, consistent with reality, of course, and I'm using, I forget which, I think this is the ESV, because of our faith, and our faith is trusting what God has revealed to us, because you and I weren't there at creation. Because of our faith, we know that the world was made at God's command. We also know that what can be seen was made out of what cannot be seen, or the things which are created are made of things which do not appear, the King James says. It's also been suggested that because of the magnitude of the claim that God exists, that there is a God, that there should be a corresponding magnitude of evidence. I believe it was the late Carl Sagan who once said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence regarding the existence of God. Now, Sagan was more intellectually savvy than I am. I'll grant him that for sure. But after contemplating this statement of Sagan's for some time, I've come to the conclusion that he was wrong. He was suggesting that the existence of God is an extraordinary claim. Is it extraordinary? Is it an extraordinary claim to say that something non-material is real? It's not extraordinary. It's quite ordinary. Now, God would be different than ordinary so far as this world is concerned, but the claim that there is something rather than nothing, or that there is a divine being who is the first cause and mover of the universe, that's not unreasonable. Everything is an effect. I am an effect. You are an effect. Everything in this room is an effect. Nothing in this room, including you or I, has its reason for existence solely within its own self. My existence cannot be explained without the existence of someone else. The existence of these pews cannot be explained on the basis of their simply being here. They have been caused. You have been caused. The air that we breathe is an effect, not a cause. It didn't create itself. And it doesn't matter how far out you want to extrapolate the thought experiment, the atmosphere, the earth itself, the solar system, and anything that we know or think that we know about the cosmos, none of it has the reason for its own existence in and of itself. You might say, well, upon what basis would you make that claim? Well, I would make that claim upon the basis of the scientific community, the scientific evidence that is out there. And the evidence is that the entirety of the cosmos had an origin point. It began. It was caused. Now, what the cause was will be highly debated among believer and unbeliever alike, of course. We will say there was a prime mover, as some of our forefathers used to say, that there was a creator who spoke and it was done, who commanded and it stood fast, Psalm 33. And God said, let there be, and there was, over and over in the book of Genesis. Or, as I think I've mentioned to you before, you can come to the conclusion that the authors of the book Who Built the Moon came to, when they realized that the moon is of such a composition and is of such a distance so as to be impossible to be anything other than created and set right where it is. It shouldn't be there. And so the conclusion of the authors, the first part of the conclusion is, well, it had to be created. It's the only conclusion you could possibly reach. But the question is, who or what created it? And their solution, and I the only thing that I can imagine is because they wanted to get away from the conclusion being God, was alien time travelers created it and put it there. So, with the same point of creation of the whole cosmos, how did it get there? Well, the options are some being greater than ourselves. And by the way, I guess alien time travelers would be greater in some ways than us. So you at least got that. But if it's going to be that nonsensical, why wouldn't we just say there had to be a supreme being? So, it's not an extraordinary claim to say that there is a God. It's not extraordinary to say that there's a non-material being that created the material universe. It's not extraordinary to say that mind is superior to matter, that mind didn't evolve out of matter, which is one worldview, but rather that matter came into existence as a result of mind. That's not extraordinary. That's just reasonable. Of course, the existence of God requires evidence. It's not a matter of more or less evidence. It's a matter of the quality of evidence. And just one quality evidence can serve to demonstrate that something bears the mark of building or design or effect. To make an illustration of that point, there has never, and when I say never, I mean that in the most absolute sense of the term, there's never been a watch or a house or a candle or a telephone or a fishing pole or a rifle or a lamp or a vehicle or a pair of scissors. But what the human mind, upon only a moment of contemplation, recognized that it was designed by somebody. In fact, we hardly call it into question. We don't even think of it. It's under our breath. We don't even conceptualize it. We recognize that created things are just that. We realize that scissors don't make themselves. We understand that our automobiles didn't make themselves. We don't even have to think about it. We probably never think about it. It's obvious. On its face, it's obvious. Should it not be that much more obvious, our own existence? Our own created universe? And there's absolutely no good reason to look at the complexity of design in the universe, or the human body, or right down to the wonderful communication device created for the imparting and sharing of information known as our DNA, that would suggest that creation is anything other than designed, and intelligently so. That doesn't require mountains of evidence. It just requires one good evidence. You don't need 800 watches to know that your watch was designed. You just need one. And if it was designed, it undoubtedly had a designer. So the argument that there's just not enough evidence for the existence of God is foolish. It's nonsensical. If one is going to say that there is no God, they're only going to be able to do so in their own mind. That's why I believe, at least in part, why the psalmist says, the fool has said, in his heart there is no God. You can't say something like that out loud and expect to be taken seriously. Reality doesn't teach that. Reality teaches us precisely what the Bible said in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4, that every house is built by some man. Now, if we accept that premise, it's not hard to go to the ultimate conclusion, which is he who built everything is God. That just reflects reality. That's the first point. The second point, the fool has said in his heart there is no God because, and this is only two possible reasons. There's plenty more, of course, but, you know, I do have to quit at some point. The fool has said in his heart there's no God because it's advantageous to the way he wants to live. That's actually more to the point of the psalm, actually. If you pay attention to the psalm there for just a moment, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. And what's the next thing that he says? They're corrupt. They've done abominable things. In fact, there's nobody that does good. And out of that group, that includes everyone, by the way, there's none righteous, no, not one. This is quoted in Romans 3:10 to demonstrate that fact, isn't it? Jew and Gentile alike are all sinners. You and I are included in that. We know that we've done things that we ought not do, and we've not done things that we ought to have done. We've sinned, we've fallen short, we've missed the mark. There's not one of us for which that is not true. Not everybody comes to this conclusion that, therefore, there is no God, but some do. And it may not be entirely because of sin. Sometimes it might be in spite of that, but sometimes I think it is. Precisely because of sin. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men in verse 2 to see whether any that understood or sought God, they're all gone aside. They've all become filthy. There's nobody that does good, not even one. So you got one of two options here. You can either turn against God as a result of the frustration of that reality, or we can seek God and find the answer to that problem. Those are the options. That's it. So, this is more the idea of practical atheism. It carries the idea that God is not consequential. Whether or not you think there may or may not be a higher power or higher being or whatever, ultimately doesn't matter, because if God isn't consequential in some way, then what difference does it make? So you can hold that idea that there's no God and nothing is consequential, or you can hold the idea that there is a God but nothing still is consequential because for whatever reason. Well, that's practical atheism. That's to live as if God doesn't exist or as if his existence is inconsequential. And where does it come from? And it seems to me that it's most likely from just a desire to live as one wishes. What else could it possibly be? I mean, maybe there are alternatives here that I haven't thought of. Seems to me that's what the psalmist is pointing out. Barnes, in his commentary on Psalm 14, said, "As a matter of fact, the belief that there's no God is commonly founded on the desire to lead a wicked life. Or the opinion that there's no God is embraced by those who in fact lead such a life with a desire to sustain themselves in their depravity and to avoid the fear of future retribution. A man who wishes to lead an upright life desires to find evidence that there's a God, and to such a man nothing would be more dark and distressing than anything which would compel him to doubt the fact of God's existence. It's only a wicked man who finds pleasure in an argument to prove there is no God, and the wish that there were no God springs up only in a bad heart." I don't think Barnes is wrong about that. That's important for us to note that the wicked person that Barnes is talking about and the wicked person or the foolish person that the Bible talks about, even in this very passage, is not necessarily what you and I might label, you know, sort of colloquially in our everyday language as wicked. A few years ago, there was a movie that came out that I thought had the most horrible title for a movie that was ever made. It was a movie about serial killer Ted Bundy. And the title of that movie was Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. I don't know, I just thought that was kind of the... It got the point, there's no doubt. I just thought it was a dumb title. Well, I'm not going to say Ted Bundy wasn't all of those things, because indeed he surely was. But it seems to me that the title is representative of something. It's representative of something in human psychology. It's an attempt to draw a distinction, to put some kind of distance or separation between someone like Ted Bundy and ourselves. That's what I think. I mean, I'm not going to get lumped in with Ted Bundy. So, terribly wicked and shockingly vile. I got to say all that bad stuff and as many adjectives as possible because Ted Bundy is, you know, way over there in a cage somewhere. You can't number me with that. It's almost like overkill just to get that separation. And there's no doubt the guy was morally upside down and inside out. But a person doesn't have to be a serial killer to be evil according to the scriptures, to be wicked, to practice wickedness, to be vile. Now, the reason why we don't like that is because we don't appreciate the holiness of God from his vantage point. So it's hard for me to say I'm wicked because I associate wickedness with Ted Bundy. But when I sin, it's a wicked act from the reference of heaven. All one has to do is decide in their heart that the existence of God is inconsequential. That's wickedness. You can live a good life. I hear this stuff all the time. Person lived a good life and gave you the shirt off their back. You know, every person that ever died that I did a funeral for was the greatest person that ever lived and would give you the shirt off their back. I'm not saying most of those people weren't like that. I'm just saying it's something we in the human psyche must do because we can't stand the idea that somewhere someone might be rejected by God that actually lived a pretty decent life. And that bothers me too. It doesn't make me feel happy. I don't have any glee about that. It's just that's what we do. Because nobody wants to think that they're going to rub shoulders with Ted Bundy in the afterlife or that their loved one is going to rub shoulders with Osama bin Laden in the afterlife. The fact is, some people who think they're pretty good people or some people that we think are pretty good people, according to the Bible's frame of reference, God's frame of reference, are eternally going to rub shoulders with all the wrong people. And the people that they hated and thought were shockingly wicked and vile in this life. Man, that's tough. It's true, but it's tough. But a person who lives as if God doesn't exist is experiencing the same heart disease as Ted Bundy, just on a different scale. I'm reminded of Saul. You remember Saul of Tarsus, don't you? Talk about an interesting case study for a variety of reasons. But here is a person who thought he must do many things contrary to the name of Jesus, Acts 26. Breathed out threatenings and slaughter against the saints of God, Acts chapter 8. Who traveled far and wide, Acts 9, 22 and 26, to commit God's people to prison. And then he held the coats of those that put them to death, really with righteous indignation. And in Acts 23, he said, I did it all in good conscience. And if that statement doesn't put the fear of God in you, nothing will. Can you imagine a person could act in such a reprobate way? A religious person could act in such a way and think they were right and thinking they were doing God's service? It's astonishing. Now, who do we think we are? When the psalmist talks about the fool and his wickedness, he's not talking about those, not just talking about those who are actively out there pursuing wickedness because they're psychopathic. Who are angrily throwing their fist up in the face of God. Which, what was the name of the lady, Glenn? Mary Baker Eddy, wasn't it? Shook her fist famously in the face of God or whatever, which is, isn't that who it was? I don't know. But anyway. The psalmist is talking about everybody who at some point or another finds it more convenient to forget God than to remember him. And I think the only reason a person does that is because they know their deeds have been evil and the righteousness of God is horrifying. Peter Hitchens is the brother of the late and notorious famed atheist Christopher Hitchens, who, as far as I know, went to his grave hating God with purple passion. But his brother Peter, who was raised like him in some European Christian tradition, wrote a book some years back entitled The Rage Against God, How Atheism Led Me to Faith. Interesting, he and Hitchens ended up on opposite ends of the spectrum on this one. In one of the chapters, he chronicles how, just like his brother, he left his faith in his younger years and embraced secularism and all kinds of things that went with it for many years of his life, and pretty much the first 30 years or so of his life. But all the while, he became more and more nagged by the constant failures of humanity to achieve real justice and real righteousness in the world. And then he realized that, well, I left my faith because I thought it was bankrupt, and now I followed all of these secular pursuits, and now I've found out they're bankrupt too. A pretty desperate situation. Well, that's what happens. The world's a desperate place. The world is a dead end. There's no doubt about that. The world is just going through the cycle. The world is like the washing machine of bad ideas, and it just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. And it looks exciting, and everybody wants to jump on and take it for a ride. And you find out when you get there that everything that's been promised is a big nothing. Well, if you've given up on God, and now you've tried the whirlpool of the world out, and you realize that it stinks too, what do you do? Well, some people kill themselves, frankly. And some people slowly kill themselves for the rest of their lives. But he had an experience. I want to share it with you. It's a bit of a passage. He remembers the moment in his life when he realized he could no longer pretend that God was inconsequential. And I'd like to share it with you. Everyone I knew then seemed to have the same view. I do not think I had a daily contact with any religious person, apart from the secretary on my first small-town paper. He was a journalist for about 20 years. I was shocked and, like Virginia Woolf, almost physically disgusted if any acquaintance turned out to believe in God. Now I was discovering that the secular faiths I held were false. I knew rather too well that what one believes and does not believe is important. I cannot imagine living without any belief of any kind. I was not capable of existing without a coherent view of the universe. But I was suppressing my loss of faith in a godless universe and my loss of faith in humanity's ability to achieve justice. My life was devoted largely to pleasure and ambition. Well, eat and drink for tomorrow we die, right? But what were those pleasures? And this is important. I'd really like to just read the illustration at the end, but you got to get this part to get it. Two of the arts, these were his pleasures. Architecture and music moved me more than any others, not because I know a great deal about them, but because I can feel their influence upon me, almost as if they are speaking to me. I'm particularly fond of Philip Larkin's line about the trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. Because this feeling that something is almost but not quite being said seizes me when I encounter certain passages of music and certain buildings. In my 30s, I found that what was almost being said seemed to be the thing I had sought to avoid so hard a few years earlier, but I still did not know what it was. I no longer avoided churches. I recognized in the great English cathedrals and in many small parish churches the old unsettling messages. One was the inevitability and certainty of my own death. The other, the undoubted fact that my despised forebears were neither crude nor ignorant, but men and women of great skill and engineering genius. A genius not contradicted or blocked by faith, but enhanced by it. He writes about staying with his wife at a hotel in France, a town he had gone to mainly in search of fine food and wines of Burgundy. But we were educated travelers, he writes, and strayed, guidebook in hand, into the ancient hospital. And there, worth the journey according to the Green Michelin Guide, was Van der Weyden's 15th century polyptic, The Last Judgment. I scoffed. Another religious painting? Couldn't these people think of anything else to depict? Still scoffing, I peered at the naked figures fleeing toward the pit of hell. Out of my usual, faintly morbid interest in the alleged terrors of damnation. But this time I gaped, my mouth actually hanging open. These people did not appear remote or from the ancient past. They were my own generation. Because they were naked, they were not imprisoned in their own age or time-bound fashions. On the contrary, their hair and, in an odd way, the set of their faces were entirely in the style of my own time. They were me and the people I knew. One of them, and I've always wondered how the painter thought of it, is actually vomiting with shock and fear at the sound of the last trump. I didn't have a religious experience. Nothing mystical or inexplicable took place. No trance, no swoon, no vision, no voices, no blaze of light. But I had a sudden strong sense of religion being a thing of the present day. Not imprisoned under thick layers of time. A large catalog of misdeeds, ranging from the embarrassing to the appalling, replayed themselves rapidly in my head. I had absolutely no doubt that I was among the damned, if there were any damned. And what if there were? How did I know there were not? I did not know. I could not know. Van der Veeden was still earning his fee nearly 500 years after his death. I had simply no idea that an adult could be frightened in broad daylight and after a good lunch by such things. I went away chastened, and the effect has not worn off in nearly three decades. I've been back to look at the painting since then, and it remains a great and powerful work. But it cannot do the same thing to me twice. I'm no longer shocked by the realization that I may be judged, because it has ever after been obvious to me. And once again, I have concluded that embarrassment was much the lesser of the two evils I faced. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There's no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They've all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There's no one who does good, not even one. Have they no knowledge? All the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord. There they are in great terror. For God is with the generation of the righteousness. Well, one thing we don't want to say is no to God. And there's not one good reason to do it. There's every good reason to say yes to God, and every good reason to say yes to His Son. Surely we don't want to be those characters that are depicted in that painting that began the change of Hitchens' life from an unbeliever, a staunch unbeliever, to some variety of believer, I don't know what. But the thing that's often missed in all of this, and I think it's a distortion that's created by sin, is the goodness of God. Is just how good God is. God knows that all of those things are true. God knows that we're selfish. God knows that we're going to choose our own way. All we like sheep, Isaiah said, have gone astray. God knows this. God knows that we're rebellious or inclined to that. But He loves us and He paid the price for us so that we don't have to suffer the consequences of that. That sounds like a pretty good deal to me. If there's anyone here tonight that's not a Christian, it would be folly as God defines it, and maybe by any other definition, to reject His Son. And if tonight you need to obey the gospel, we would encourage you to confess your faith in Jesus and repent of your sins. Put Him on in baptism tonight. Go on your way rejoicing. Or maybe there's someone here, a child of God, who needs to make things right once again with the Lord. We would encourage you to do that. If we can help you in any way, won't you let us know as we stand and sing.
All persuaded now to